This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, John Oliver, spoke with Terry last Thursday. After being a correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart for 7.5 years and guest hosting the show last summer, John Oliver now has his own show of political satire, Sunday nights on HBO, called Last Week Tonight.
I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait, you're not going to really do a comic take on the death penalty, right? It's your second episode. I haven't even decided if I like this show yet.
The show is remarkably good at taking complicated, underreported, and what some might call boring stories and making them informative and really funny. Here's one example from a few weeks ago. The subject was net neutrality, the idea that the internet should be a level playing field with all data being treated equally, whether it's coming from a big corporation or a little startup. The FCC is endorsing rules that would end net neutrality and create a data fast lane for companies willing to pay a premium price. But the issue is sometimes discussed in hard-to-follow technical and bureaucratic language, which is where John Oliver comes in.
Our government looks set to end net neutrality and let these companies run hog wild, and we're just going to let them. And you know why? It all comes back to this.
It seeks comment on ways to construe additional language in Section 706 and even suggests using Section 230B to broaden the scope of the commission's usurped authority.
Oh my God, how are you still so dull? And that's the problem. The cable companies have figured out the great truth of America. If you want to do something evil, put it inside something boring. Apple could put the entire text of Mein Kampf inside the iTunes user agreement, and you just go, agree. And that's why advocates should not be talking about protecting net neutrality. They shouldn't even use that phrase. They should call it preventing cable company because that is what it is.
John Oliver, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your new show. I really love it. Is this part of how you see your show taking things that people might dismiss as being too boring or too complicated or, you know, not relevant to their lives and showing why it's interesting, important, and how you can actually make it funny?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, we've only done 7 shows.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't really know entirely what we're doing at the moment. But, yeah, it's worked out so far. We've kind of been drawn to things that are not being covered, really. And net neutrality is that would have be a key example, because that is the most important thing that is honestly too boring to care about. And yet it is a pivotal moment in a very, very key issue. So, yeah, it took a week of sifting through almost paralyzingly dull footage to try and work out how to present it. And so, yeah, that's what we're trying to use our time on at the moment, or we have been. It's been that, or, you know, the death penalty, or the Indian election. Nothing that makes you scream, oh, this is going to be inherently hilarious.
The weird thing is that I learn things from watching your show. Like, I hadn't been paying attention to the Indian elections till I saw your show, and it seemed like, wow, that's really interesting. But it's embarrassing for me to admit that.
I can take that from people in the street, but if Terry
it's horrible.
Gross is
I know,
saying that,
I know. It's
we're
awful.
In such trouble as a nation. You're the canary in the coal mine.
Well, you'll save us all.
If Terry Gross doesn't know about the Indian election, we're in serious trouble.
Well, thanks for embarrassing me even more than I was already embarrassed. So to show, like, not only do you take subjects that some people really – a lot of us are not paying sufficient attention to, you not only make it funny and interesting, then you get people to respond. And I'll go back to the net neutrality piece. After describing how the end of net neutrality creates a two-tiered system in which providers can charge companies a premium to send massive amounts of data more quickly, like Netflix could be charged more, you explain how cable companies would benefit by a two-tiered system. Then you point out that the FCC, which regulates the cable companies, is headed by the former head of the industry's lobbying arm, which you compare to needing a babysitter and hiring a dingo. I think I just proved your point I just put this in an incredibly boring way, even though we've covered this on our show, and I know it's an incredibly interesting subject. I just made it sound kind of dull, maybe. But anyways, after you describe the problems of ending net neutrality and why that could be very unfair. You say that the FCC has a website for comments on net neutrality, and that you wanted to directly address the internet commenters out there. And this was a call to action. So here you are addressing the internet commenters, asking them to go to the FCC site and make their opinion heard.
For once in your life, we need you to channel that anger, that badly spelled bile that you normally reserve for unforgivable attacks on actresses you seem to think have put on weight, or politicians that you disagree with, or photos of your ex-girlfriend getting on with her life, or non-white actors being cast as fictional characters. And I'm talking to you, Ron Paul fan 2016, and you, One Direction forever, and I'm talking to you, One Direction sucks. We need you to get out there and for once in your lives focus your indiscriminate rage in a useful direction. Seize your moments, my lovely Charles. Turn on caps lock and fly, my pretties.
I love the way you managed to not only get people to comment on net neutrality on the FCC site, you insulted the people you were getting to comment. You insulted all internet commenters.
Although you could make anything sound euphoric with big music behind it.
So what had happened? It crashed the FCC website.
Well, the FCC website crashed. I don't know if we had anything to do with that. I think the fact it crashed shows there's bigger problems. If the FCC's website is designed for people to comment on, if it's crashing when people are commenting, there is a much bigger problem than our involvement. There is clearly, I don't know much about website design, but it seems they have a serious infrastructure issue there.
So in introducing the net neutrality piece, you said the only two words more boring than net neutrality are featuring Sting. Mm-hmm. Do you worry that one day you will be at a party with Sting and there will be a chill in the air because you said that?
Of course, but that is the key thing. You've hit on a profound truth in comedy there, and that is that what you can never do is then be at parties that Sting would be at. And that's true of basically everyone I ever make fun of. As a comedian, you should not be in rooms where the people you're making fun of also are, because you'll realise at the end of the day, they're just people. You can't risk having that kind of compassion infect your mission to attack. My solution to that is not to curb my jokes. It's to not put myself in the same room as the consequences of those jokes.
But that means with every year that you're doing satirical comedy, there are fewer rooms you can enter.
Yeah, but that's what you're supposed to be. A comedian is supposed to be an outsider. You're supposed to be outside looking in. I don't want to be at parties in DC with politicians. The comedian shouldn't be there. If you feel comfortable in a room like that, there's a big problem. That's what's so concerning about when you see journalists so comfortable around politicians. That's a red flag. You know, there should be a kind of awkward tension whenever a journalist walks into a room that politicians are in, because you should have done things that have annoyed them in the past. And the same as a comedian, you're no one's friend. You should be no one's friend other than other comedians.
So there's things that you can do on HBO that you couldn't do on The Daily Show. One of them is use expletives, and another is show nudity. Total nudity. You've taken advantage of both.
I have.
And I want you to explain in radio-friendly language what you did about campaign ads.
Well, we wanted to look at the race in Kentucky, which is set to be the most expensive race for Senate of all time. So we wanted to take a look at what Kentucky is getting for that. You know, it's the normal kind of poisonous, vacuous invective from two political sides not trying hard enough. That would be the nutshell. And so what we decided to do was show, because you're on HBO, you know, the moral wasteland, that if you're going to throw that kind of money at insulting each other, you may as well take the nuclear option. And so we made an attack ad for each side, one which was incredibly violent, and one which featured Mitch McConnell in all his natural glory. Is that radio friendly?
It wasn't really Mitch McConnell, though.
Well, we don't pan up. You don't know. I mean, I don't want to burst the mystique here. Yes, it could have been Mitch McConnell. If it was the actual Mitch McConnell, I would be in jail by now. That's, yes. That's all I'll say.
I'll just add, it was an older person's man parts.
It was... God, if nothing else in my career, I've got Terry Gross to say the phrase, it was an older person's man parts. And if that is an audio gif waiting to invade the internet.
Well, you know, I was thinking, like, did Mitch McConnell contact your show and say, you can't get away with this? This is not right. This is like a humiliating kind of mockery that crosses the lines of good taste. Not that comics adhere to the lines of good taste.
Yeah.
But did you get pushback?
No. No push. What's he going to... He can't possibly... That's a phone call he can't make. You can't... This is... Your pushback to that would be, this is America. I can absolutely do that. No, he's not an idiot, despite, significant evidence to the contrary. There's no pushback to have. There's a certain point at which context is only going to excuse some of what you're doing. But that was the punchline to a much broader piece about how pathetic the race in Kentucky had been. And it was just taking the race to its natural logical extension, which was, the background to it is that Alison Grimes had been attacking Mitch McConnell for being an old man who's out of touch. He had been attacking her for destroying coal. So the attack ad for him was Alison Grimes with a chainsaw in an incredibly graphic image butchering coal miners in underground, just with blood and kittens flying everywhere. And then the natural extension of her campaign is an old man's parts, as you so delicately put it.
Thank you.
So it was linked. There is a logical link to the actual campaigns that they're running. It's just taking them to their logical extensions, which are disgusting. But I would argue that the seeds of their campaigns are already disgusting. You are just watering those with premium cable. And they're provoked. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Those are two things that come from a real place, and that is that their campaigns are awful.
Last summer was a big summer for you, because when Jon Stewart was in the Middle East directing his film, his forthcoming film, mm-hmm. he asked you to host for him. And you were fabulous hosting the show, and that was basically the consensus of opinion. And I just want to play a short excerpt of what I think was your first night hosting after Jon Stewart left you in that position.
Before Jon left, it was very sweet. He was very warm and supportive, and he actually gave me this little note here, and it says, "Don't worry, you'll be great." That's nice, although subjective. Besides, no big news stories ever break out over the summer.
U.S. officials acknowledge that intelligence agencies are secretly collecting millions of Americans' phone records on a daily basis.
Private calls of Americans, whether they've been suspected of a crime or not.
Are you kidding me? John's been gone one day! One day! We had such a fun, gentle first show planned for you as well. A few harmless I'm British jokes, like, this is a football, not a soccer ball. We call it a football. Halfway through the show, we were going to break and have a little tea time. And then at the end of the show, I was going to fly off at the end on with an umbrella. It was just a bit of fun. Just a bit of summer fun. And instead, Jon Stewart is barely out of the door. And it turns out that not only is the government tracking everyone's phone calls, but that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Now we're hearing it goes way beyond phone records to our internet habits and who we email with.
The National Security Agency is building this massive new data center in Utah.
This is a mammoth facility. The published reports indicate that it can hold 5 zettabytes of data.
Zettabytes? You've actually got to be careful with those. I think that's how Michael Douglas got throat cancer. Boom! Hey, he left you! John left you! I'm here!
That's John Oliver last summer, substitute hosting for Jon Stewart when Jon Stewart was making his movie. Were you really shocked when all this breaking news happened, and with Did you consider that, not in terms of the health of the country, but in terms of your ability to put on a good show? Was that good news or bad news?
I guess it was good news, because, you know, the summer's usually, the problem is it's usually quiet, especially in a non-election year. But that particular summer was not quiet, and that was true from day one. Yeah, that Snowden story broke literally just before our Monday show. So it was, the whole thing was a blur. There was, I guess it worked out, because there was no real time to panic, because we just had to do what we normally do, which is kind of write a show. It's just without the guy who helps us do that. The whole summer was very difficult.
So what kind of real advice did Jon Stewart give you before he left for the summer?
Gave me lots. He gave me lots of advice. I don't know how transferable some of it is, because it's so specific. You know, it helps me every day now, thinking about it, you know, running my own show. But I think there was one day, to be honest, in particular, that was very, very difficult, and it was something that I'd been concerned about going in. And I'd said to him, if something really, occasionally something, when something really painful happens, there are times when people just want to hear from John about it. And, you know, there have been times in the past when he's helped people, you know, with comedy to kind of feel some kind of catharsis through some very difficult events. And I said, I'm worried that I have no authority to occupy that position. You know, I can make fun of things, but that if anything painful happens, I'm worried that it's unearned. Any authority I have is unearned. And he'd said, well, now would be the time that you would have to earn that.
I want to play your last appearance on The Daily Show. And In this, like, Jon Stewart is setting up your piece. You're sitting at the desk with Jon Stewart, and he's setting you up to talk about the royal family.
Yeah.
So here we go.
You know, it's funny. I thought that went pretty well. Do you think that went well? That bit?
Why?
I just thought it was funny that like, did you think us discussing this was like that we got laughs?
Yeah, a few.
Right.
Well, not bad.
Do you think it's weird that we worked on this all day? This the bit we did here, like, because it's like, it's a, I don't know if you know this, but like John Oliver, how long have you been here?
7.5 years.
7.5 years. But John, because, and we've all known this, you're a tremendously talented individual. You know that. You know we know you're tremendously talented. John,
they were going to applaud whatever you said. Then.
John got his own show on HBO, which is long overdue, and we're very excited for him. But this is his, unfortunately, his last night with us. And I went, well, it's true. So I today went through this enormous, I guess your people would call it a charade, of writing this f-ing royal nut bit.
Are we not doing the bit?
No, of course we're not doing the bit. Do you think? What do you think we're doing here?
I thought you cared.
No, I don't care. I don't care.
I thought you
know
cared
what?
About
There's only
queen.
One British royal I care about tonight.
Uh-huh.
And his name is Prince John Oliver. So let me show you. Here's what I want to talk about a little bit. So you came to us from, I think you came from us, Ellsbury on Lightly. I don't remember the town
I
you come
as
from.
Well.
Muffin on Puffin stuff.
That's offensive, but fine.
It should be. But what I loved about what John brought to us was a broad range of characters from different backgrounds.
John Oliver, you seem to be totally thrown by the fact that this piece that you've been writing and preparing all day was a charade, and it was basically a surprise party for you.
Yeah, it was very difficult.
We could see you wiping tears from your eyes. And John, I thought John Stewart looked surprised, like he wasn't expecting you to be that emotional. And he was almost a little concerned.
I think. Well, the problem, the moment when I fell apart was that I think he could see that I was getting upset towards the end, and I don't know if you can even hear it on camera, but he brings me in. He said, he asked me, "Are you okay?" And I just fell apart, because that was just such. It was so emblematic of the way he'd been with me over nearly a decade, which was constantly checking if I was okay, helping me through things, teaching me how to do things that I perhaps should already know how to do, you know, before he left for the summer, when at a time when he had no time, when he had a movie to prepare. He was so generous with, you know, giving me advice on how to run things, when there can be problems in the process, how to feel when something like this happens. He helped me with everything. He was always so generous. And then so at that moment, the fact he said, "Are you okay?" That was, I'm afraid, my elegantly constructed British dam was was broken.
So you are an American citizen now?
No, I've got a green card.
Oh, I thought when you were married you became...
No, actually, do you know what? This is a funny story. The last time we spoke, Terry, it was years ago.
It was 2010.
And I think... that's right, it was 2010. And I think you talked about my... I think she was just my girlfriend then.
That's
and
right.
I think you, yeah, and I think you said, is she your fiancé or something?
I called her your wife, yeah.
Yes, now... That came with repercussions for me, Terry.
No, oh no, what did I do?
I hadn't realised the extent to which people listened to your show or at least have it on in the background of their lives. Because there were extended relatives of her that just, of my now wife, who heard the word fiancé and started calling my wife's family saying, "I had no idea she got engaged."
You know what I think? I think you might have said soon to be wife. She's not my wife, yep. She's my soon-to-be wife.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, it worked out, Terry, but you inadvertently accelerated that process. Yep.
What did your now wife have to say? Was she in on the fact that she was your soon-to-be wife?
I don't know if she was in on it. No, I don't think people ever quite believe it until, you know, justifiably until it happens. So I think she was... there was a certain amount of eye-rolling of, oh, well, isn't that hilarious? My family think we're engaged and we're not. Isn't that funny? What a funny thing to have happened.
John Oliver, it's just been wonderful to talk with you. Thanks so much and congratulations again on your new show.
Thanks, Terry. It was a real, real pleasure.
John Oliver spoke with Terry last Thursday. His new show of political satire is called Last Week Tonight. It's shown Sunday nights on HBO. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, has a review of the new third album by Parquet Courts, a band from Brooklyn by way of Texas. The quartet has drawn comparisons to New York rock and punk acts as various as the Velvet Underground, the New York Dolls, and Sonic Youth. But Ken says this album, called Sunbathing Animal, proves Parquet Courts is an original.
You've been ducking and dodging, but you can't come home no more. You've been ducking and dodging, but you can't come home no more. That king you got won't hit this rock no more. That king you got won't hit this rock no more.
The rapidly strummed electric guitars, the slamming drums, the jittery bass, the shouted vocals. Yes, Parquet Courts is doing its best to remind you why you like punk rock in the first place. While the band is not opposed to stretching out a groove, one song here cracks the 7-minute mark, the essential strategy is to state the verse, let the verse do the work of a chorus, and let you try to figure out the words. That's Always Back in Town, essentially a list of habits and behaviors sung by bandleader Andrew Savage in his sweet and sour croon. The composition operates as a repetitive drone that finds a healthy momentum and maintains it, the musical equivalent of a fighter doing jump rope training. Springy and agile, this is well-muscled music as performed by guys who like to moan and complain a lot.
An aerosol.
Parquet Courts creates songs that dare you to be irritated by them. They stick with a riff like that one, a song called Dear Ramona, and shuffle into it lines such as, "Whoever she might be going to bed with, you can read about that in her moleskin." There's an undercurrent of sarcasm there, and I would be surprised if the Parquet Courts boys don't own a few moleskin notebooks themselves. But making clever snark develop into something more emotional, more revelatory, that's the challenge the band sets for itself. On that Sunbathing Animals title song, Parquet Courts plunges headlong into its invigorating take on post-punk rock music. When I listened closely, I heard over the course of the whole album a certain snippy attitude toward women cropping up a tad too frequently, as in that song's line about fang-toothed woman foaming at the mouth as she addressed me. The band is also inordinately fond of what I would call the Bob Dylan surrealism adjective, as when, on another tune, the singer says, "Let me slip into my insomniac shoes."
Time waits over behind your shoulder, and the onset of your wandering year. Until you're not the same old fool you once took yourself. Slip into my insomniac shoes. Step out the door into the garden of my unpainted.
These wise guys give themselves as much of a hard time as they give everyone else, and it's that self-awareness that redeems this exhilarating music. Parquet Courts is great at making anyone's misery sound surmountable, including its own.
Ken Tucker reviewed Sunbathing Animal from the group Parquet Courts. Coming up, author Josh Ferris talks about his new novel, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli in for Terry Gross. Staring into the mouths of his patients all day, the dentist in Joshua Ferris's new novel becomes obsessed with decay and death. He wishes he had religious faith and could believe in something larger than himself, but to him, church is just a dark bus station of the soul. Something else this dentist doesn't have is his own website. He doesn't want one. But someone impersonating him starts a site, as well as a Twitter account, which he uses to proselytize for a religion that sounds ancient, but that no one's ever heard of. Joshua Ferris's new novel, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, is his third book. His first novel, Then We Came to the End, was a satire set in the office of an advertising agency during the end of the dot-com boom and the beginning of the bust. In a review of the new novel, Lauren Groff wrote in the New York Times Book Review, Ferris is, quote, as brave and adept as any writer out there, unquote. He spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Joshua Ferris, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from the very opening of your novel.
The mouth is a weird place, not quite inside and not quite out, not skin and not organ, but something in between, dark, wet, admitting access to an interior most people would rather not contemplate, where cancer starts, where the heart is broken, where the soul might just fail to turn up. I encouraged my patients to floss. It was hard to do some days. They should have flossed. Flossing prevents periodontal disease and can extend life up to 7 years. It's also time-consuming and a general pain in the ass. That's not the dentist talking. That's the guy who comes home, 4 or 5 drinks in him. What a great evening. Ha-ha's all around. And the minute he takes up the floss, says to himself, what's the point? In the end, the heart stops, the cells die, the neurons go dark, bacteria consumes the pancreas, flies lay their eggs, beetles chew through tendons and ligaments, the skin turns to cottage cheese, the bones dissolve, and the teeth float away with the tide. But then someone who never flossed a day in his life would come in, the picture of inconceivable self-neglect and unnecessary pain, rotted teeth, swollen gums, a live wire of infection running from enamel to nerve, and what I called hope, what I called courage, above all what I called defiance, again rose up in me, and I would go around the next day or two saying to all my patients, you must floss, please floss, flossing makes all the difference. A dentist is only half the doctor he claims to be. That he's also half mortician is the secret he keeps to himself. The ailing bits he tries to turn healthy again, the dead bits he just tries to make presentable. He bores a hole, clears the rot, fills the pit, and seals the hatch. He yanks the teeth, pours the mold, fits the fakes, and paints to match. Open cavities are the eye stones of skulls, and lone molars stand erect as tombstones.
Oh, thank you for reading that. That's Joshua Ferris reading from the opening of his new novel, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. Why did you choose dentistry as the opportunity to reflect on the inevitability of the body's decay and ultimate death?
Well, I guess it started when I was probably 22, 23, and I went to the dentist, and I said, what is going on with my mouth? I had a gum problem that would seem to be the result of typhus or, you know, the prick of a needle on a beach somewhere. And the woman just looked up at me and said, the dental hygienist, she said, son, do you floss? And I said, no, of course not. That's a ridiculous question. Flossing is no fun. And she said, floss. And sure enough, that took care of my problems forevermore. And I thought it was absolutely fascinating that something so simple and sort of, you know, known. I mean, I knew you should floss, but I didn't know that it could actually help my gums. And from that moment forward, I flossed, and I flossed every day. And something so simple was so relieving of pain. I was kind of fascinated by dentists from that point forward.
But you also have the dentist being the observer of the body's decay because he's looking at decaying teeth and bone and wounds in the mouth and sores. And so, like, he's just the observer of the deterioration of the body.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we go into the dentist, basically go in, sit in the chair, try to bear up, and then flee, you know, as quickly as we can. Here's a guy. I'm thinking of a guy who's got to be there every day, 8-10 hours a day, who has no relief from that decay, who has no relief from the worst mouth problems that people suffer from. And he's already kind of dour, you know, he's already kind of a pessimist about the world. And when he has to spend all of that time inside these wrecks of mouths, it just sort of makes things worse. So it works him down and works him down to the point where at the beginning of the book when we first meet him, he's pretty much in constant despair.
And at the beginning of the book, he pretty much finds his patient's pain and his patient's mouth problems to be oddly reassuring. He says, like, now you know what he knows, that luck runs out and death is inevitable. And he talks about the enjoyment of watching the entitlement end. The immunities of great privilege have expired. You're no different from the next guy. You're mortal, and it's ugly.
Yeah. Fun thoughts.
I don't think my dentist is like this at all, by the way. I have a great dentist. I really don't think he takes pleasure in my pain.
Well, you know, it's wonderful when you can go into the dentist and feel that, you know, things are pretty good. The dentist tends to remind you of pain and the possibility of decay and disease. And I think that's part of the reason that dentists are sort of chronically misunderstood. And nobody wants to go see a dentist. It reminds you of some of the things that, you know, you would prefer to go without. I don't know that he's celebrating people's awareness, but because he's so painfully aware of the daily problems that he confronts, he might take a little bit of comfort, as you say, in the recognition by other people who live blithely that they too are mortal and have these concerns.
The dentist in your novel, the main character in your novel, wants something greater than his work and golf and playing banjo on the side. He says, I would have liked to believe in God. By believing in God, I could succumb to ease and comfort and reassurance. Why can't he believe?
I took as the basic premise that a kind of heaven on earth is a religious identity. The ability to believe comes with the reassurance of immortality, of forgiveness, and also, I think, a community of like-minded believers. This guy is so reasonable in a kind of neo-atheism way, in the kind of Dawkins-Hitchens model. Any divinity whatsoever is off the table. So I started with that basic premise and wanted to see where he lacks because of that belief. Does that highly reasoned and kind of commitment to atheism, what does it do to a person in his life? Does it make him cramped at all? Where does he find community? These were the questions that I began the novel with.
He really would like to believe, and he says about his chief dental hygienist, Betsy Convoy, who's a widow. He says about her, I always considered her alone, but she was never alone. She was with the tripartite company of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. He envies people who have faith.
Yeah, absolutely.
He thinks they're wrong, but he envies them.
Yeah, you know, if he could believe, he would believe. You know, he's just too committed to the rational creed of atheism. What he sees all around him, however, are people who are believing, who do have those reassurances and comforts that are discussed early in the book, and that have a community, have a built-in community of people who not only believe like them, but also support and comfort them through the night. He doesn't have that.
So the main character in your novel, the dentist who looks into rotting mouths all day and sees his job as part mortician because he's dealing with so much decaying and already dead tissue, do you think in part he craves religion because he sees because he looks mortality literally in the face every day?
I certainly think that's one of the things. I mean, he's making things bleed constantly. He can't quite get out of that mode. And so that's a kind of permanent reminder of not only how we end up and the misery and pain that may overtake us at the end of life, but I think it makes him question people's behavior and why it is that we've been placed on earth. Have we been put here to make meaning, or should we just sort of blithely and obliviously move through our days without concern for the larger questions? And so I think these things are entering in his restless curiosity for how we should conduct life is coinciding with his constant reminder that we're mortal, that the time we have on earth is limited.
Your main character, the dentist, grew up Protestant, left his faith. His ex-girlfriend is Jewish, and he envies Jewish people because of secular Judaism. The fact that you can basically be an atheist but still be a Jew and still derive cultural identity and a sense of belonging to a tribe. Did you experience that yourself?
When I was growing up, my mom took us to church in a kind of fitful way. I mean, she meant to go every week, but of course we missed some weeks because we were just busy, or, you know, I had siblings that were crazy and we couldn't get into the car fast enough, so we would skip church. And we went to a couple of different Protestant denominations, so I actually joked to her later on in life that we had multiple denomination syndrome. We didn't know where we belonged, you know. One week we were Catholic, the next we were Lutherans. So I kind of share with the main character a biography that just is a little adrift religion-wise. When I was in college, I would look in on people who came from much stronger traditions, and they were carrying their traditions through college. They were committed to them. They were hanging on because it gave them, you know, some tether to the communities that they left, the homes that they had left. And I really envied it. I saw a lot of strength there. I saw a lot of beauty there. I saw the attachment to traditions and religions that I didn't have. And I envied them, I think, in the same way that my main character does.
Joshua, in your novel, somebody eventually steals the online identity of this dentist. The dentist doesn't really have an online identity. He doesn't do social media. He doesn't have a Facebook page. But suddenly there's a Twitter account in his name. There's a Facebook account in his name. And the person who has taken the account in the dentist's name starts posting these biblical-sounding passages that really aren't from the Bible at all. And I'm going to ask you to read a couple of short excerpts from these passages that sound biblical but are not.
If thou makest of me a god, and worship me, and send for the psaltery and the tabret to prophecy of my intentions, and make war, then ye shall be consumed.
Let's stop right there before you read the next one.
Okay.
So he's basically saying, hey, don't do this in my name. Don't make war in my name.
The God of that passage.
The God of that passage, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, he's saying, you know, look, all is well and good. Believe in me. That's fine. But certainly don't conduct war in my name. And if you don't, then I will guarantee you safe passage through the world. This is obviously a very different approach, I think, to, you know, the gods of many religion that basically say, I am the one God and the only God.
Okay, read another excerpt.
And Sophek gathered us anew, and we sojourned with him in the land of Israel. And we had no city to give us name, neither had we king to appoint us captains, to make of us instruments of war. Neither had we laws to follow, save one. Behold, make thine heart hallowed by doubt, for God, if God, only God may know. And we followed Sophek, and were not consumed.
Okay, so this is very biblical sound, you know, very fake biblical sounding. There seems to be a God, but you are hallowed by doubt. To believe in this God, you must also believe in doubt. That kind of doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a big contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I should say here that we don't know, at this point in your novel, we don't know who's writing this.
Yeah.
And we don't know, initially they think, like, is this part of the Bible that I don't remember?
Right.
And they realize, no, definitely not part of the Bible. They don't know what this is about.
Right.
But getting back to the question of a God that tells you that the main thing you have to have is doubt about God, what sense does that make?
Yeah. Someone has made a website in his name for his dental practice. And that's freaky to him. He doesn't quite understand. And very upsetting. When they start posting these pseudo-biblical passages, he assumes they're from the Bible. And it gets him even more upset because now they're not only impersonating him, but also making him seem like a believer, which he's not. He asks his dental hygienist, Mrs. Convoy, who's the Roman Catholic, where's this from? And she says, you know, this doesn't sound like the Bible. This doesn't sound like at least the New Testament. So at this point, he's in unknown territory. As it turns out, this is a very specific God to a very specific religion that he's about to learn a whole lot more about. And that religion specifically asks its followers to believe in a God whose only dictate is that they doubt him. Well, that's a tough one. You know, it's full of contradictions and it doesn't make any logical sense. But a little later in the book, one of the impersonator, maybe the only impersonator, asks him how logical other gods are. And he points out that the Buddhist who must discover nirvana has to do that by realizing a self that does not exist, but the self must discover its own non-existence. Jewish belief dictates that you believe that God made man in his image, but man is full of evil. Christianity dictates that you believe in God, who is also a man of flesh and blood. So there are a lot of illogical definitions that get ascribed to God. And I was just sort of following along those lines. You know, God himself does not need to be resolved of contradictions. In fact, it is one of God's greatest qualities that he's riddled with contradictions. So I suppose that this follows along those lines. You know, how can you believe in a God who demands that you doubt him? Well, this is, ironically, for a religion founded on doubt, the real question of faith.
Joshua Ferris, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Joshua Ferris spoke with Terry last Tuesday. His new novel is called To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Adam Stanishevsky. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.B. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancula.